National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. My name is Eleanor Mermelstein. I am with my partner, Sylvia Busis, on Tuesday, July 17, 1984, interviewing Mr. Harry Katz at his home. Harry, let us begin our second interview by your recollection of your childhood memories.
Okay, well, in the early 20s, I was born in 1915, so I remember things from 6 or 7 years on. One of the first things I remember is putting together with my neighbor next door, a Polish boy, and we had a spool and we put wire on it, and he got a galena and we put it and we on our ear, and we heard some noises, and they said, "This is KDKA radio." It was probably the first year that KDKA started on the radio, the first in the whole world. And we were hearing these noises, music and other sounds, and that was exciting. No electricity or anything. One of the other memories I remember from Canonsburg is a parade. I think it was 1922, and it was a long parade, and in the parade was a big black square Ford sedan, the biggest ones that they had, and there was a little old lady. I don't suppose she was very old, but to me she was. And she came to Canonsburg because she was given the first gram of radium that was produced in the world. She came from France. She's the one who discovered radium with her husband, I believe. And she came to get this little precious bottle made in Canonsburg, which was the first place in the world that made it. The other thing I remember is the old streetcars that used to go from Canonsburg to Pittsburgh and to Washington. They had a potbelly stove in the wintertime. They heated it up, and they had two, a conductor and a driver, and they had a bathroom, and it took an hour, and they swayed like old Toonerville trolley. And I remember bringing chickens, carrying a dead chicken, helping Mama come to Pittsburgh because it was fresher and so forth. And I remember that they delivered merchandise in the middle of the street, freight. There was no trucks in those years, so all the stores that were in the middle of the Canonsburg were delivered, and people had to stop and wait for them to unload. I remember the older fellas talking, bragging about how many cars they could drive. There was hundreds of different kinds of cars in those years, and each one had a different kind of a gear shift. And you had to be very a good mechanic to know how to drive all the various cars. In those years, if you saw a motorcycle, the only person who would ever use that was a policeman. A policeman used a motorcycle. I remember in the drugstore up the street, where they had a little 15-watt bulb that you could hardly see, and I used to reach up in a jar to get what we called a whorehound. That's a sugar candy. But I had to be careful because right next to it, there was things moving. They were selling leeches to take care of bags under your eyes or black and blue. And this was a normal medicine that the pharmacist had, selling leeches to people who wanted to suck blood out of their skin. And I just remember that vividly. Then we came to Pittsburgh periodically to meet Bubby and Zadie, and I'd stay there the whole summer, and I have some wonderful memories from there. And they lived at 2323 Reed Street. And Zadie had a milk place, and he had a barn and behind his house, which faced on LaPlace Street. And there was, I think, a half a dozen or more cows. And he used to milk the cows. And I remember to this day, my favorite beverage is milk. And the milk, of course, that we drank there was warm. It had hairs on it, which didn't bother anybody, didn't bother me. I got immunized against everything with those. And it was full of rich cream, and it was so sweet that to this day, my favorite beverage is milk.
What section of the city was Reed Street in?
Right off of Soho Street, near Kirkpatrick Street. And there's a lot of Jewish people lived around there, and a lot of Irish, all kinds of people. And it's near the Weill School, one block away from the Weill School. And I remember the sukkah there, and I remember living in the sukkah, not sleeping, but eating in there. Even if it was cold and dark, it was still, you had to stay out there to eat dinner in the sukkah. And I used to help him make deliveries with the horse and wagon. And one day he told me he had to stop somewhere to collect some money from somebody, and he told me to stay the next place I should leave a gallon of milk, and I should leave it at the place where the horse stopped. He didn't have to tell me. The horse knew, Prince knew where to stop. So that's really an automatic delivery. And I remember helping Uncle Sam make these deliveries. Then I remember the table was a big table, and they never was a time there wasn't a visitor in there for dinner or stay overnight or something. That was the most hostel that there was. And they couldn't afford all the food for everybody. Meat was very expensive, and it was making a meager living as a dairyman. So Bubby used to make the tastiest bread. It was like cake. It was so tasty that they passed it out. And when Zadie used to take that big round loaf and put it up to his neck and cut it with the knife against his neck, I was nervous, but that's the way they cut bread that time. And they passed out these thick slices, and then they did it again and passed out another slice. And by the time they had eaten two of those big slices, the meat was enough. They passed out a little bit of meat for everybody, and so they could enough to go around. And then I remember a Shadrinner Michael that Bobby used to make. It was a potato, a whole potato, and they sliced the cap off, and then they hollowed the inside, and they took ground meat, and they braised it with onions, and then put it back in with the potatoes. And put the cap back on and put it in the oven and baked it. And what a Michael that was. And that was inexpensive, because this was a big potato and a little bit of meat made a big meal. And it was, to this day, we call it the Shadrinner Michael. My wife makes it, and people in our family. And I don't know why it's not known by the rest of the world, but it's a fantastic meal. And I remember going up the street with the cowboy, Paul Pollock, and he used to drive the cows up to a big hillside behind the Montefiore Hospital. The Montefiore Hospital was an old house, a mansion, on Fifth Avenue at the bottom of Heron Avenue. And there was a big hillside in the back, and beyond the hillside was Brackenridge Street and Avalon Street, and the baby home, and Gusky baby home. And this big, maybe about 5 acres, is where the cows ate all day. And I used to go with the farmer, with the cowboy, to drive them home. And once I was so embarrassed, the only way they can go home is through the streets. And they went down the streets, and the streetcar was clanging, and then one of the cows decided to make. And so people had to wait, and he clanged his horn, and then Paul took a shovel and shoveled the stuff over the ditch in the gutter so that the rain should wash it down. In those years, 1922, this could happen. I can't believe it. But one of the things that did happen was that the inspectors for the city of Pittsburgh had a field day going around jumping on everybody's trucks or wagons and testing the milk and finding out that people put water in. They got more mileage out of the milk. But when they saw Hanek with that beard, they didn't waste any time, because there was always much more cream and butter fat than there was supposed to be. And he was the only dairyman who had to buy butter for his family. That's how fanatically honest he was. And the house was at 2323 Reed Street. And I remember the hospital there, and my brother, little younger brother was had his tonsils taken out. All kids in those years had to have their tonsils taken out. That was best medical science at that time. And so he went up to the Montefiore Hospital, and I visited with him, and he was in a ward. And the ward was a porch, back porch that was closed in. That was the ward. And this was the Montefiore before they moved. I stayed there for the whole summer, and in the winter I'd come occasionally, and I remember the winters. I used to sleep in the attic with my uncles, Dave and Sam, and the windows were so open that wind blew snow in, and I remember the heavy perina that didn't matter, it was warm because it was all real good duck down that made these perinas just real warm. But this is the kind of houses people lived in those years, and that was normal. Then as I got older, I traveled often, but when I was about 12 years old, I had a horrible case of acne, and our doctor said the only way to cure it is with x-ray. So every week I would come into the old Skin and Cancer Foundation, which was on Eureka Street in Oakland, near Oakland Avenue, in around there, near Myron, I forget the exact place. I think there's a supermarket in there now. And I would get, they would cover me with a heavy lead thing, and I could still smell that ozone or whatever the smell is from this heavy dose of radiation. Why my thyroids weren't affected, I don't know. But my children weren't affected, and 69 now in fairly good health, and that apparently didn't have any effect on me. One of the things that I remember in Canonsburg when I went to school, when I had to walk past the Catholic school, they had a parochial school, the Catholic kids threw stones at me, so I had to walk half a mile out of my way to go to school to keep them. That was their sport. This was in 24, 25, 26, and there was times when I was knocked down. I was called a Christ killer, and I had problems with my Gentile friends. And while I was in school, of course, when they doubled up in a classroom very often to hear a special lecture, automatically I was put with a black kid. The Jews and the blacks were lumped together. In those years, there was Catholics were not a majority. They were a minority, and they were looked down upon. And the town was essentially Protestant and Republican. And my father really had everything going bad for him. He was not only a Democrat, but he was a Jew, this was in small towns or in much of America, this was pretty bad if you were not a WASP. And Catholics were not much better than Jews in the eyes of the Protestants. How different that is today. I did mention about my father's store.
That, yes, you did.
That I started that and how I built that up. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about my bar mitzvah when I was 1929. That was the year that Hebron in Israel was wiped out for the Jews. They had a massacre and killed the Jews that were there. Made a very deep impression on me. Ever since Abraham's day, Jews lived there, and then this was a year when they were massacred. And well, I was bar mitzvah in 28, and I remember the bar mitzvah celebration. Went to shul, and those were days when you're not allowed to serve whiskey. And how can you not have a bar mitzvah without wine or whiskey? So Mama made herring and cake and kichel, and that was it. And that was the whole bar mitzvah. And after I made my speech, in Hebrew, and I sang it. That was, I think I did it pretty well. And they were all, mother and father were proud of that. And then they served the cake and the kichel and the herring and the bread and the schnapps. And then we had a basket, and there was no kitchen there to wash things. So all the dishes that we took from home had herring on it and so forth. So we, just by accident, we somehow put the half-empty bottle of schnapps in the bottom of the basket. It was one of those old crummy baskets. And we put dishes on top with the dirt, because there was no garbage can or anything. And when the police came, and the police did come, because one of our fellow Jews could make $5 by reporting a case where they could make a catch. And if they made a catch, he got $5. So he told them there would be whiskey, and you're not allowed to have whiskey in Prohibition at all. So so when the policemen came in, and they would not open up that. The herring was, so the dishes were so dirty with herring, they're not going to pick up a dirty dish with herring. So we were spared a fine and going to jail, because this was a very serious offense. If they were able to give him $5, that was a big thing. Our rabbis never lasted longer than a year. In a little town like that, everybody had a different opinion of what the rabbi should be. They paid them very little, but they expected a lot. So we never had a rabbi to last more than a year. So I never learned anything more than brachos, because every year each rabbi was going to start over, all over, to teach his way. And they started brachos. Next year was brachos again, and another rabbi brachos again. Never lasted until Exodus at all. That was the nature of small towns constantly switched rabbis like that.
Can you tell us something about your courtship with Ruth?
Oh, all right. I'll get to that after. That was in the 40s, and after the war. But in 1939, I don't know if I mentioned. I did mention last time about the B'nai B'rith and the AZA and my activity there. But in 39 or 38, when Hitler was at his worst, was very bad. The Women's Club of Canonsburg had the chutzpah to ask me to play music representative of German music. Every month they had music played, a singer or a violinist or a piano or something. And at that time I played violin, and so I said okay, but I picked only Mendelssohn and Jewish composers from Germany, and I played that. I thought that was, I didn't play any German music but Jewish music for them. If that's what they asked me to do, I gave it to them. Then I went in the army, and I believe I mentioned the fact that I was fortunate in the army to be working in the White House. Did I mention that? Okay. When I came back for a 3-day pass one day, I'm standing on Forbes Street waiting for a streetcar to take me to Squirrel Hill to visit my my aunts there. My father and mother were both dead, and that's all I just wanted to see. Aunt Belle and Bess wasn't there. As a matter of fact, I saw Bess on the street. She was in a car, and she saw me. I'm on a corner waiting. And she had a guest with her, and the guest was a neighbor from Rochester, PA. Aunt Bess lived in Rochester. They owned a theater in Rochester, PA, and she came frequently to visit with her sisters and brothers. And she had her friend with her, and this was Ruth Gordon. And Ruth lived, actually worked in New Jersey. She worked for Social Security, and I asked her to visit with me in Washington, D.C. So she came, and we had a delightful time, went to a very nice restaurant, And I was just overwhelmed with her. I really was. I just love at first sight. Well, I proposed that night. And
when were you married?
We were married when I came out of the Army in 46.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a wonderful marriage.
Where did you live at that time?
Well, we moved into an apartment in on Melwood Street. And the rabbi who married us was Rabbi Shapiro. And he said he had to visit a home in Melwood Street. Somebody had just died. That was Jewel Horvitz. Jewel Pachman Horvitz died. Her father had just died. And we went, took him there because he had to visit there, and she was an aunt. And here it turns out that since he died and they didn't need the apartment, they let us, we took over that apartment with the furniture, with everything, and it was a godsend. That didn't cost us very much. We stayed there until we moved to Eastmont. In Eastmont, the houses were cheap enough. Things were starting to look up a little bit. And I moved here in Eastmont, not thinking about Jewish life, and that bothered me that there was no shul. But I figured with all the Jews that were moving, somebody was going to build a shul.
Did you already have a family when you moved to
Eastmont?
No.
Oh, wait a minute. Yes, Elliot was born in 48. I was married in 46, and we moved here in 53. All right, so Elliot was definitely here. And when we came here, we were here only about, we were a few weeks here, and it was Christmas time, and I saw a half a dozen Jewish homes had Christmas trees, and that was burning me up. And so the spring came, and the summer was already here, and there's still no shul. And the neighbor next door had a little boy, and the neighbor was named Erwin Zimmerman, and he was a playmate of mine on Reed Street back in the 20s. And he had a little boy, and they needed a minion for bris. So we called a minion, called different Jews, and then I sent out a postcard to all the Jews that I knew that there would be services in my basement. Well, I didn't realize that that was going to continue for a year and a half. And my basement had high holiday services. And Ruth was very much worried about washing clothes in a room where they had a Torah, so we had to put a curtain in there.
And this is the house?
No, the house was at 131 Delaney Drive. That's in Eastmont. It was a six-room house. And we had Sunday school there and Hebrew school. And we had a lot of people belong for $10 a year. Boy, everybody belonged. And I had a little mimeograph machine. I still have it. I keep it for sentimental reasons, which I used to run off notices. And once the baby was born at 8 o'clock at night, and everyone had the notice the next morning because it just happened I would run that off at night, and I put the stamps and I had everything arranged, took it up to the post office, and everybody got the notice, and that was remarkable. And I kept up a steady barrage of good propaganda for the shul. Things were going good. And then came a time when they were going to stay there forever for $10 a year. Why not? And the real reason I had to build the shul was to get them out of the house. So I found a farmer. Well, first of all, we tried to find a lot that was available, and Miller, Samson Miller, was willing to donate us three lots that were not very good, but that would be just big enough for a parking lot. So we found a place from a farmer who sold it to us for a price that we could get. We needed money, so I went to a Jewish bank, what's his name, down on Washington Street, he died.
Halpern.
And he said, yes, he'll lend us money, but he wanted a high interest, and he wanted 25 people to sign. It was an impossible. And then he wanted my business. So I said, I'll let him know. So I went to a stranger, Pittsburgh National, and they gave me a better deal without only six signatures and with lower interest and so forth. So they loaned us enough money to put this, but that still wasn't enough money. So I went to the Hebrew Free Loan and I made an appeal to them, and they were willing to help us. So they came out to my basement, a committee of three people, and they interviewed a couple dozen people, and they gave them each, loaned them $300 each, and maybe it was about 20 of them. So that was enough money for us to get by. And apparently I made an impression on them. So soon after that, they asked me if I would be a member. And I've been a member of the Hebrew Free Loan for a great many years. And I really enjoy that mitzvah very much, able to help. How much time do we have?
I would say about 2 minutes. Okay.
Just a little bit more here. We're like at 4:14. It goes to 5, doesn't it?
So we had a thriving community of about 165 families, more or less, and had an active Sunday school, and we attracted a lot of traditional Jews, because the rabbi was a controversial person, but he was traditional, and nevertheless, people who are traditional don't really care too much about who the rabbi is. They come to shul because it's a shul, and he was able to get a lot of money. And we first, I'd like to talk about how we built the building. That's a miracle how that building went up, and maybe it would be. I'll catch that on the next section.
You have some time on
okay,
this.
All right. Exactly sure what all right, so we built this. First thing we got was this lot. And the day was August the 14th. And Rosh Hashanah was September the 16th. And here we just bought the property. And if I didn't put that building up something, the whole thing would have caved in. Because nobody thought we had the money. People did not have big income. This was very low income area. And to put up a building for $25,000 was like putting up something for $1 million. And it was impossible. So I got the money from the bank. And then we had exactly 30 days to put up a building. So first we have to get everybody together. So we sent out a postcard right away that night. We have a meeting in 2 days. And 2 days we had a meeting in one of the churches here. And that was a knockout battle like you never saw. We really fought and yelled and screamed and so forth. But the final result was they passed it. The next morning the concrete truck was already there. Why? Because I already on my own had contracted a excavator, and he dug out the basement and he dug out the trench, and everything was all ready for it. Now, on my own, I was taking a big chance. And we had a member who was an architect, and he already had all the plans, and everything was in order. So on the day that they passed it, that night, the next morning, we already poured concrete. The next thing we had to do was worry about getting steel, and I was told that the steel would take 9 months. In 1955, it was a black market. You couldn't get steel on the normal channels. And I went to Levinson Steel, and they said 9 months. That's it. I said, but we have to have this building up for Rosh Hashanah. Ready? So in Rosh Hashanah, was only 30 days. So they said, impossible. I said, nothing's impossible. Just keep trying. And every day I nudge it. And the contractors went ahead and they put the block up. And Philip Cohn was a contractor. God bless him. He did miracles. And he had everybody putting it up. And even on Saturday, they turned their head the other way. We have to work on Saturday. And I believe on Sunday, too. It was no other way. Finally, they finished the walls. And they couldn't do anything more because there was no steel for joist. And 11 o'clock they finished, and the guy said, what am I going to do? I have to send him home. I said, please, maybe he'll come. 12:30, the truck comes with the steel. It was a miracle. They found somebody who didn't need it right away, and had to happen to be the right size, because this was made to order, these bar joists. So when the last day arose, this was the picture. This was a half hour before Yom Tov. The building was up, the roof was up, but there was no doors, no windows.